All right, before I get started today, I just thought I'd mention one thing. I got some email from somebody saying that these videos are taking way too long to download and therefore play. They're about 400 megabytes. So if you're on a very slow, if you're at the end of the internet spectrum, it's going to take you a while to download and play those files. So what I did is I stripped out the audio part, which is a good deal smaller, and now I've attached audio to each of these as well. So if you want to just listen rather than watch, you may now do so. Okay, what I'm doing is simply replacing the old MP4 files from last year. So anything where it still says audio MP4 is left over from last time. You'll notice that the first two lectures where my recorder broke down or failed on me still have that. But just to sort of put us in context, here we are today, October 18th. Beginning chapter 4. We'll continue and finish chapter 4 next Tuesday. That means next Thursday, a week from today, we'll go on to chapter 5. Chapter 5 is a little shorter, so it's only a single lecture. And then October 30th, the Tuesday of the following week, we will have a midterm exam. In here, during class time, it will be a probably 45 to 50 multiple choice question test. You know the format. You've done it many times before. I don't need to go over it with you again. But please do bring in the small size Scantron sheets, not the full page ones, the half page ones. I believe they're sort of pinkish, reddish color. And I think they're even cheaper. That way it takes up less space in my office when I have to keep them for 2 years before I can throw them away. Okay, questions about the midterm? A couple of people asked me how to study for it. That's fairly straightforward. Review the lecture materials that I've been leaving on the web for you. You might want to just quickly look over the labs that you've done and make sure they make sense and look at the concepts that they're trying to reinforce. And then the textbook, I've sort of put in some sections there to help you study for the test. One of those is the quick study guide section, which simply runs the content of the entire chapter into one paragraph. My daughter was working for Harper's, the magazine in New York, when I came up with that idea, and she was responsible for putting the whole week's news in one paragraph on their website. So I just simply copied her idea. Okay, any questions before we launch back into chapter 4? Yes? It always helps to look at old tests. I've gone back and looked at my exam questions over the last 15 years, and not a heck of a lot of difference in there. So you might want to just look at the old study questions.
So those ones that are online from the book are your actual?
They are, but they're several editions out of date. I hope to make up a completely new test this time around, in which case I'll put the old test, or rather last year's test, I'll replace the one that's currently on the website. I'll wait until I've actually done that before I substitute it, but let's say within a week or so, before the test at least. Other questions? Okay, so let's launch into chapter 4, in which we're going to study how to get the map into the computer. And I always think of a sort of ideal here would be, imagine there was some kind of slot in the front of your computer where you just, it said map on it. You could simply take a paper map and feed it into that slot, and that same map then mysteriously appeared as a layer inside your GIS, all geo-rectified, all the features converted and available for you to use. Well, we don't quite have that situation in hand yet. Not that we won't have that in the future, this issue of how we get the map into the computer has a significant role to play. Even if the map was captured into the computer many years ago, we still have to live with the limitations of the system that captured it. Not only that, we have to live with the limitations of the particular map that was digested and all of its errors, which may go back a generation or two in terms of computer cartography. Okay. So I'll be hitting some of these lessons along the way as we go through the material in Chapter 4. All right, this is the way it's structured. We're going to start with what is essentially an analog to digital conversion, getting the maps into computer and what it represents. We'll briefly talk about that. I'm going to emphasize in particular today section 4.2, finding existing map data, because we're in this very fortunate situation where, at least if we're studying here in the United States, we can pretty much find any piece of data that we want from a geographic point of view out there somewhere on the World Wide Web. That's certainly not the case in other countries and other parts of the world. And indeed, we have this irony that the data poor nations, the places where we really need the best data, have the worst data. So we have to deal with those issues. But I'll go over some of the sources of map data that you may wish to try out for yourself. We won't get to it today, but when we pick up again next Tuesday, I want to talk about the two principal methods for getting maps into the computer directly. Digitizing, or putting a map down on a digitizing tablet and capturing its features one by one, which can be extremely accurate, but it's a very demanding and it's a very error-prone way of capturing maps. And many of the legacy errors that we find in geographic data sets, their sources are originally human and come from this process. And then the other option, which is to simply scan maps, and we'll look at this process of scanning and what that entails, and indeed how it's done and how it generates data sets. We'll wrap up by looking at field data. Increasingly, we talk about sensor webs and measurement systems that go out into the field, collect data, perhaps GPS registered to geographic space, and then bring that in and want to use it within a GIS. I've been working for a couple of years now on Tom Smith's data, who's an ornithologist at UCLA and has an enormous amount of tracking data from Africa, where he's got birds rigged up with these giant hornbills rigged up with GPS receivers that collect 2 points a day from these birds as they fly around in the forest. And analyzing that kind of data is very much what GIS adds as a capability. And then image data, the use of overhead and perspective photography and imagery of all types. We'll look at how that has quite radically changed GIS. We'll lastly talk about data entry, and that primarily means entering forms or attribute data with GIS. We'll go over how to do that. And the last thing we'll look at is editing and validation. How do we make sure the data we have inside our GIS is correct? And if it is correct, if it's not correct, how do we correct it? Okay, so let's start, launch right in. Maps inside a GIS have undergone this digital conversion. They are not analog. When we look at a paper map, it is very much visual. But when we look at, as we saw in the last chapter, when we look inside the GIS, that same map just consists of a whole bunch of numbers. Maps have a communications function, that is that when we see them, we can interpret them and extract information from them, especially thematic maps. But we often overlook the fact that maps also have a storage function. When maps are stored in a GIS, if we archive and store the digital data, then hopefully it's available to other people who might also want to be able to use it. That's been a major role of the federal government, as we'll see in just a minute, in providing all sorts of information to us. A paper map has this incredible ability to store map for very long periods. Maps that were printed 500 and 600 years ago, because they were printed on such high quality paper and with very high quality organic inks, have survived in beautiful intact form right up to today. So if you said, will a digital storage medium be able to store digits for 500 or 600 years, you'd probably have to scratch your head and say, well, maybe not. I've got a whole office full of CD-ROMs that are all slowly decaying. They're only a few years old. So certainly 600 years might seem out of the question. So somehow the visually stored information or the content of the visual needs to get digital. And one way to or at least talk about and explain this context has been raised by Hal Mollering, a cartographer, in this idea of real and virtual maps. He said that any map can have at least two manifestations. One is its tangible form, usually on paper or perhaps on the internet, in which we can actually look at it and perceive it. But the other one is in its virtual form. So you might think of a GIS database has the capability to generate any number of all sorts of different maps from the equivalent information. But those are indeed virtual maps. They have yet to be created. So think about maps that exist that now need to be archived and saved and interpreted versus those that have yet to be built from the data that exists for them. Now, this idea of data conversion used to be what we talked about a lot in terms of GIS projects. So typically a GIS project, let's back up and say we're in 1982 now, and we need to do a GIS project. We need to map all the drains in Santa Barbara County, let's say. Well, there is no existing map of the drains in Santa Barbara County, so we need somebody to go out, walk all the streets, put them on the map by hand, then we need to bring those maps back, capture them with a digitizer, and eventually build a database showing all the drains of Santa Barbara County. Traditionally, the cost of doing something analytical in GIS, about 80% of that cost was just assembling and putting the data together, converting the data, in many cases, from analog to digital. Perhaps maps did exist, and in fact, for drains data, Santa Barbara County, we actually have some very good WPA, you know, ancient data maps created that map many of the drains in Santa Barbara County. So there the issue would be, can we get those maps, bring them up to date, and convert them and put them into digital form? But the early literature that looked at this saw the cost of GIS as prohibitive in this case because 80% of the cost was simply building the data. Well, that assumes that the data is only going to get one use. You'll do one project, you'll decide on, you know, what the 10-year plan is for drains in Santa Barbara County, and then you'll throw the data away and never use it again. But that really is inefficient. And in fact, one thing that GIS enables is that any one person that collects data for any purpose can very easily share that data with anybody else that might want to use it for a completely different purpose. So this idea of reuse is very powerful. It's a very powerful thing that GIS can do. Data, so we see the difference between data creators and data analysts and users begin to form. These become different agencies. The agencies that get the responsibility for map creation, I'm going to cover them some of these today, at least from the federal point of view, and to some extent the state. But the reason it's difficult to create and continually create databases is because they require maintenance. You know, as I always say, the day you finish a mapping project, all of your maps are out of date because it's taken you a while to do the project and the Earth continues to change. Things are created and destroyed in the real world that are not reflected in the current status of your maps. So doing the edits and keeping the data set up to date is an important part of that data conversion effort. And again, you try and ask, say, the NSF or a funding agency for, you know, $100,000 forever, a year, just to be able to maintain the data that I created for a particular research project, they would just laugh at you. They'd want you to get rid of that responsibility. And then the other aspect is that very often we think about, well, we would really need to map the drains of Santa Barbara County and do it once and do it well. But from a sort of broader perspective, perhaps a global perspective, it's best if we map all the drains in all the world and do it with one consistent specified standard and then keep that up to date. Now, when an entire theme gets updated for a whole area or a whole area of reference, we call this a collection, typically because it was often collections are often what gets managed inside a library. So a library would regard, let's say, every issue of a journal of a particular type as a collection of all the issues of that journal. So to the library, one copy of every 7.5-minute quadrangle map in the United States, all 42,000 of them, represents a collection. And of course, the status of that collection is changing continuously. It takes, you know, months just to drag every single map out and put it on the table. Okay, technology, of course, is continuously changing here and making the problem to some extent more complicated, but in other respects, easier. So initially, what GIS users wanted was raw data. They wanted to capture new information to use in the GIS and to use it one project at a time. So they wanted to be able to process the data for themselves. Let's say that part of their data project might involve bringing in aerial photography from which they were going to identify wetlands, and then they were going to use the wetlands layer as part of their project. They would assume the responsibility of that acquiring imagery, figuring out how to identify wetlands, digitizing the wetlands, and creating the wetlands layer just for their purposes. But a lot of other people have a vested interest in the map of the wetlands. And for one thing, it's just one component in a land use map. And some other agency might be far better at actually taking on that function, who could then hand you exactly the piece of information that you want. So as we've seen, data reuse makes a great deal of sense. If you look back at the early days of GIS, everybody was creating their own version of everything. You know, there were 10 different county outlines for the US. There were dozens of different land use maps and for each county and so on. So the next stage was that everybody created tons and tons of data, but nobody knew it existed. That's the discovery aspect. So the first thing that the web enabled us to do was to find out that somebody else actually had the data that you wanted. So this is the first task, the issue of discovery. The second part is simply searching and finding the data set and getting access to it, which is usually getting it from some archive and downloading the data and ingesting it into your database. So these two components, search and discovery, led to a whole generation of what were initially called clearinghouses or data clearinghouses, and later became web portals, and I'll show you some examples of them today. The clearinghouse idea originally came out of the federal government. Several congressional studies found that the US federal government had many different agencies producing pretty much the same kind of data, but doing it their own way, sometimes in incompatible systems. And it would be much better if one agency had responsibility for producing its type of data and then shared it with all the other agencies. So this idea of a clearinghouse was the first way of having all the different government agencies like FEMA and Department of Interior and so on be able to share the data among the agencies. It makes total sense, and not just from a sort of cost point of view. It makes sense because everybody starts with exactly the same geographic coordinates and the same definitions of features. You don't end up with alternative definitions of the map. Now these days the internet's moving towards what are called web services rather than clearinghouses. So here you'll often find that that the web browser is acting as perhaps as a broker. So it's actually it's looking for and finding the pieces of information that might be of interest to you. Very much like the intelligent software within Amazon. You know, you buy a book on Amazon, which I did this morning. Very quickly you start getting notices of things that are like what you just selected, or new things that might be connected to what you just selected, or some other purchase that you might have made recently. That's an artificial broker. It's analyzing your needs and then doing a search based upon what it believes that you're interested in finding. So let's say I was going to apply a particular hydrologic model that needed four input layers. As soon as I download and start working with the hydrologic model, I would expect an intelligent geographic broker to be out there looking for the data that I'm going to need to feed that model for my county. So we often say the buzzword that now is solutions and not data, the idea that the user interface is going to allow or provide you with the analysis, and the data is going to be something that sits out there in the cloud that you never necessarily have to download onto your machine at all. You can just connect to the data as you need it. And then, of course, queries for data can be tracked, and this is exactly how Amazon works. Every time you order something, you know, you sacrifice a little bit more of your private information to the great machine out there that's trying to analyze what it is that you do, or in this case, who you're going to vote for next. So what comes next? Well, I don't know. We'll revisit this very same issue in the last lecture when we look at the future of GIS. So let's go in a more traditional sense to how do we find map data, because when I first started teaching this class many years ago, it was straightforward. There was no data. You had to go out and find the map that you wanted to capture to put into the GIS so you could do the analysis that you wanted to do. Well, that's no longer the case. So now it's a question of discovery. So we'll begin the path of discovery here with me talking to you, but obviously the best way to do discovery is to use Google or use some search engine to find the tools that you want. So I'm a great believer in some of the traditional sources. One of the most educated sources for finding map data is a map librarian in a map library. We have a very good one here on campus, in the Davidson Library. If you go over there, generally speaking, you're dealing with human beings, but they're very knowledgeable human beings. They are the expert brokers. They're just not inside the computer yet. They're still human beings that you have to converse with. So they can very often tip you off to data that you might have known existed, or refer you to somebody on campus that perhaps already has the information that you're interested in using. In 176C, when we do projects on either the county or here on the campus, typically we never need to acquire new data, or very rarely need to acquire new data. It's just a question of finding out in the first few weeks of the quarter who has the information on campus that you need and making some kind of contact with that person. Okay, then we have the portals and the search engines. I'll call these reference sources. I've already mentioned data.gov, but there are a large number of databases that are set up for the express purpose of allowing data discovery within a context. So data.gov was set up for the federal government, and it has a geodata.gov branch that allows you to go in and sort of sit above all the agencies, but nevertheless drill down and search for particular types of geographic data. We have in California the Teal Data Center, which plays the same role outside of the government, but we have also pretty good data available from the from ca.gov. The California site actually is very good at providing California-wide data, so often a good place to go. States and local agencies, they vary tremendously. Some of them are extremely good. States like Delaware and Vermont, which are very small, got in charge of GIS very long ago, and consequently have really excellent GIS data. Connecticut, another good example. Other states have lagged a little bit. Some just sort of neglected their responsibility at the state level and passed it down to the counties. So you have rich counties that have very good data and relatively poor counties that have almost no data. And you can look at any map of the US and figure out which is which. Many counties barely have a GIS operational, and typically only have one employee who has to handle all the mapping for the entire county. And that's not just the routine stuff, but also things like permits and zoning operations as well. So very often that's sort of neglected side. On top of this, we have the commercial data suppliers, and there's no shortage of that. For the sort of raw map data, we have Rand McNally, Thomson, Maps.com, huge number of map suppliers that will supply data commercially. National Geographic is another good example. And then we have sort of add-on companies that would be gladly selling you data like LIDAR and satellite imagery and overhead photography and so on. So this is a huge market by itself, the producers of map-related data. It's an enormous industry. Back 20 years ago, there were a great many companies, maybe about 12, that were producing digital map data for common applications like newspaper mapping or routing or even Google or Apple Maps. But we saw a huge shakedown in the last 4 to 5 years, where these companies sort of ate each other and got bigger and bigger. And now we're left with two. And these are two companies called TeleAtlas and Navtech. You've probably heard about these. About 2 years ago, TeleAtlas was bought by TomTom, that makes in-vehicle navigation systems, and Navtech was bought by Nokia, the mobile phone manufacturer. And these have become the sort of giants of digital data production. They hire huge numbers of people to go around with GPS receivers to put more and more things on the map, and then they update and sell their digital maps. So here's the Navtech website. Yes, indeed, they do have their own data, but they also primarily are data suppliers. So what they're trying to sell you is an entire database, and they're quite happy to truncate it to a county or to a theme or to your country. because Navtech is a worldwide company. It will sell you data for anywhere in the world where it's done mapping, and it's mapped many, or almost all the world now. Here's TeleAtlas and their website, a little bit out of date now, but TeleAtlas probably a little stronger in Europe. But again, enormous quantities of information that they have available and they're willing to sell at a price. And it means that once you have the data, you have to meet their sales conditions. You can't just simply redistribute their data or sell it again, because they have the copyright on the information. Now, you probably heard recently about the so-called fiasco of Apple deciding to replace the little icon on here that used to take you straight to Google Maps. Where is it? It's not on that page. Used to take you straight to Google Maps, that now takes you to Apple's own mapping app API. Now, I shouldn't criticize this too much, because more than one of the students that came through our program and work in Apple's division that does this, and one of their leaders, in fact, was a PhD student who graduated recently. But you've probably seen the controversy over this. Apple basically bought, here we see the Apple app over here. Apple bought very similar, well, they developed their own similar capabilities to Google Maps. We'll look at this a little bit later in the quarter. And then just simply bought data from the principal data providers, principally TeleAtlas, and then put out their application. And Google, of course, does pretty much exactly the same thing. But Google now has about 10 or 12 years of experience in maintaining, updating, and improving that database, and Apple has just stepped on board. Apple launched directly into three-dimensional data, for example, and there you can see the result of a three-dimensional view of a highway interchange that you get out off of Apple Maps. And this is because of this way of taking panoramic photography and then merging it together to try and present a single view. I won't go into some of the stories. You've probably seen them in the press, whole cities mislocated, etc. Now, commercial entities are not the only way that we get maps into GIS. I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about the federal government, but we've recently seen a sort of a third branch emerge, and not only emerge, become dominant. And that's what's called the Volunteered Geographic Information Community. And Volunteered Geographic Information, or VGI, is data that comes from you and I. It's contributed by people who have some kind of GIS capability and are willing to go ahead and give their data up for the public good. So OpenStreetMap.org was a response of what was then a graduate student at UCL in London, who got dissatisfied with what's called the Crown copyright on British maps by the Ordnance Survey, which all fall under Crown copyright and has some of the strictest copyright restrictions in the world in terms of use and reuse. Now, that's in contradiction to the US policy, which we're going to look at a little later today, of open data, you know, public source information. So the response was to set up a piece of server software which allowed users to contribute their own GPS tracks into a system that could automatically update and correct them, tabulate one against the other, and then systematically build a map of the world. They decided to start with streets, so they called their website OpenStreetMap, OpenStreetMap.org. And OpenStreetMap is a user-contributed map of all of the streets in the world. Now, obviously, it's an ongoing project. If you go to OpenStreetMap and open up one of the tabs, here where it says GPS traces and user diaries, you can actually see all the GPS tracks being uploaded. You sort of see the time zones of the world going by as everybody gets home from work and uploads their driving track of the day up to the system that then very quickly releases the new map. So mostly the history of OpenStreetMap has been filling in the map of the world in terms of streets, but people have started building tools that go on top of OpenStreetMap, allow you to download a chunk of the map and add your own details. So we've had what are called parties or crisis sessions sometimes, where we get students together and bring in the OpenStreetMap for the our neck of the woods, or at least for the campus and IV, and then bring in photography and remap and up to date, and bring the information up to date, and then post it back into OpenStreetMap. So you see that I've always said the Isla Vista and the campus, probably some of the most detailed and accurate maps there are in the world, because we've had students continuously updating with volunteered information. Of course, there are errors inside OpenStreetMap. There are whole parts of the world where there's nothing on the map because nobody's been along there or been willing to contribute information about that region. But in, ironically, in many cases now where time is of the essence, and the example everybody talks about is the Haiti earthquakes of a couple of years ago, OpenStreetMap had a sort of crisis session where they brought people in to very rapidly update the map of Haiti. And we did some of the sessions here at UCSB. And as a result, the map of Haiti and Port-au-Prince, the capital, was so complete and so well mapped by about day three of the emergency that all the aid agencies and even the U.S. federal government gave up using the maps they had in hand and started using the OpenStreetMap digital map because it was more accurate. So I say this is kind of a third way of producing data. You can, since it is open, and it's all user-contributed, it's assumed that anybody contributing the data yields up permission for anybody to copy it. So you can simply you can hit the export tab and export the data in any GIS format that you choose for any area that you choose and bring that data into your GIS. Since you can do that, Esri's already done it for you, and you can download it directly from ESRI into ArcGIS. Now, data come from an enormous different number of sources and across different media. I wanted to include on the left-hand side print media because in spite of yet another magazine going out of operation today and going all digital, there are still print media around. Newspapers, I still read one every morning. And maps and things printed in newspapers are still a very important outlet for topical information. This one happens to be the the LA Times. The LA Times has been very successful in setting up interactive mapping opportunities. They did one around crime mapping and murders in LA County, where they continuously updated the homicide database so that you could trace murders and see where they were happening and in some cases why. So also we also have, of course, Google Earth. Google Earth, an enormous provider of imagery as base reference data, and Google Maps, the equivalent of base map data. But the imagery and the maps that Google provides are proprietary. Not from Google, but from the data suppliers. Many of the suppliers are public agencies, in which case the data is open source, but many are not, like TeleAtlas. So we can't use the data without permission. So Google Earth and Google Maps are in a kind of precarious situation where they can provide a view, they can provide a solution like the directions to the shopping mall, but they can't necessarily give you the data to use in a GIS. On the bottom here is one of the CIA's maps. The CIA is a major provider of information worldwide. They produce something called the CIA World Factbook, which I would argue is one of the most up-to-date and probably impartial sources of information that you can get about different countries around the world. It's all digital, but it also includes digital map data, the CIA map series, many of which can be downloaded and used inside GIS. Here's the map for Ho Chi Minh City, for example. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the sources of existing map data, and they're pretty much everywhere. So again, the question is one of discovery. So we might find it through a map library, we might find it through a network search, or we might find it on media, or perhaps even disk. This is very relevant to you here as students in the University of California because we have something called the California Digital Library, of which the UC is a major component. And the holdings of any one of our libraries are available for any of the other libraries. So a student at Berkeley, let's say, or Davis, who wants a map that's in our map library can request it. But it's much easier for them, obviously, if they get a digital version of that map. So what they're actually requesting might be a paper map, it might be a CD-ROM containing a map, or it might be a map sitting on disk that they can just access. here at UCSB was developed something called the Alexandria Digital Library some 10 years ago, when this was a prototype for most of the search engine type, geographic search engines that we're going to cover in just a few minutes. So UCSB was at the forefront in some of this technology. Data providers, the people, the source of new information, new map information, usually make it available via the web, and networks of file servers available across the internet. So we often, you look at the sort of the face of Google, just warehouses full of these massive file servers. Data producers often have the same situation, where they've got terabytes or more petabytes of data to distribute. They need to keep it on disk and make it accessible, and may need to have duplicate backup and so on. So we've ended up with these suites of tools, web portals, search engines, clearinghouses, all mechanisms for discovery. So discovery means this is sort of the two stages. First of all, does the data already exist so that I can just take it from them? And the second stage is search and access means, can I find where it is and can I get it? That's the next and very important stage. Okay, lots of commercial vendors out there. TomTom already mentioned, each one of the digital navigation devices has its own databases. The TomTom that I have at least has exactly the same little memory card that you get for your computer or for your camera, and you need to update that from their website every once in a while and load it back into the machine, otherwise you don't get all the new roads and whatnot. Some of the other major agencies, maps.com I mentioned because it's still located right here in Santa Barbara. It's sort of a map supplier from the analog sense, but also to some degree a digital map supplier. They've employed a lot of our students. National Geographic, and I should mention, to be fair, full disclosure, I do work for National Geographic. I'm on their committee on research and exploration. But they have applications that provide a lot of data too. And I often mention DeLorme Mapping Corporation because they were one of the first to get into the mapping business around handheld GPS receivers